Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
Psychiatrist, have you ever had a patient that genuinely scared you? If so, why? Story one. I work as a psych PA now, but this was earlier in my career when I was still a therapist. I once worked with a man who had antisocial personality disorder. He was out on parole and said he really wanted help. He wasn't the right fit for our program at the time, so I only had him for about an hour while I set him up with other care. He was very smart, well-spoken, and honestly pretty charming. Still, I kept my office door open because he gave me an uneasy feeling, and over the next few days, people kept asking me who he was. He told me about some things he had done, things like fraud and pretending to be a doctor at a local hospital more than once. His case file actually backed up his stories. During our talk, he stayed calm and pleasant, but I noticed how sharply he could read me as a person. He made these unsettlingly accurate comments about me and my life. You could see how he had been able to trick and take advantage of others in the past. The way he described it all so smoothly made it clear how convincing he could be. I've worked with people in deep distress, including kids and adults others might call frightening, and that doesn't usually bother me. With them, you can often understand what they've been through and try to help. But this man, he was honestly the most unsettling person I've ever worked with. Even now, I get chills remembering him. On the other side of things, I once worked with a young man who had gone through a lot of trauma. He had a history of being aggressive with both people and animals, and I worried he might end up stuck in the system. Years later, I ran into him again. He was grown, getting married, had a baby on the way, was working full-time, and had even moved his family far away to escape negative influences. He recognized me, remembered our time together, and even asked if he could give me a hug. Back then, I felt like I hadn't made a difference with him, but that moment reminded me that maybe I did. Seeing him doing so well filled me with so much hope. It made me proud to know he was building a good life, and that I might have played even a small part in that. Story 2. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I once worked nights in a mental health center. I would often be sent to whichever unit didn't have enough staff. There was one unit in particular that always stood out to me. The whole place was kept in darkness, except for the nursing station, which was lit up. Sitting inside that glass station felt like being in a locked aquarium. We could see down all the dark hallways, but everything outside felt shadowy and unsettling. There was one patient I'll never forget. She wore a padded full body suit and helmet so that she could move around safely. She couldn't really communicate with us, but she moved constantly, crawling along the floors and walls in the dark. We had to keep a close eye on her and redirect her gently when needed. At night, she would sometimes slip into other patients' rooms. If we didn't notice in time, we'd hear someone shout, and then we'd rush in to guide her back out. The image of her shape crawling in the pitch-dark hallways is something that still makes me uneasy. It wasn't that she was aggressive. She wasn't. It was a fact that we couldn't reach her, not even non-verbally. There was never that spark of human connection. I often fed her, and she would move restlessly in her chair, but she knew to open her mouth when the spoon or fork was close. Still, she never made eye contact with me. No matter how much we talked to her, encouraged her, or tried, I never felt like we truly connected. That absence of recognition, that feeling of her being locked away from us, is what unsettled me the most. One of my co-workers, I'll call him Mike, once told me something that gave me chills. He said that while he was feeding her, she suddenly seemed to snap out of it for a brief moment. She looked at him and said, "Thank you, Mike," and then just as quickly went back into her usual state. That thought haunted me, that she could still understand, still speak, still know who we were, but was trapped inside, unable to share it. The idea that there was a whole person in there, unable to come out most of the time, was the most frightening and heartbreaking part of all. Story 3. I once worked as a psychologist in a jail for young adults ages 18 to 24. There was one young man who really shook me up for a while. He was only 18, but he was already involved with a street crew and had taken someone's life. In group sessions, he was always loud, trying hard to act tough and intimidating. But in one-on-one sessions, he was surprisingly calmer, easy to talk to. Honestly, those sessions were usually kind of dull and uneventful until one day. That day, out of nowhere, he leaned forward and, in the calmest voice, told me my home address. Then he added that he could go after my family. That moment froze me. Normally, work never followed me home. I could leave it all at the jail. But this time, it stuck. For the next few weeks, I was constantly looking over my shoulder. I couldn't shake the feeling that he might actually do it. It's been years since then, but I still remember that uneasy paranoia. That was the first time my work ever felt like it had broken into my personal life, and it left me rattled for a long time. Story 4. I was working as a paramedic when we got called to a house fire. When we arrived, the parents were outside, sobbing, holding a baby and a 7-year-old. At first glance, no one seemed injured, but we still started checking everyone to be safe. Then our captain directed us over to a squad car where an 11-year-old girl was sitting. I won't go into the darkest details, but the truth was she had started the fire. When asked why, she calmly said it was to get rid of the baby. We later found out this wasn't the first time. It was actually her third attempt. She had already been placed in treatment facilities twice before. Years earlier, she had even tried to harm her older sibling, which is why the family sent her to live with her grandparents for a while. She was unlike anyone I'd ever met. She didn't look scared or upset. In fact, she seemed amused, giggling while her parents cried and her sibling sobbed nearby. But then, the moment she realized she was being sent back to a treatment center, it was like a switch flipped. Suddenly, she was begging her parents to help her. Then she started making wild claims, saying things that weren't true, insisting they weren't her real parents, even saying she didn't live there. Something clearly happened in her past, but her story changed so often it was impossible to know what was real. We ended up being at that scene for over 2 hours, which is far longer than most calls. Later, I learned from my cousin, who works at a state psychiatric facility, that she had been admitted there multiple times through the years. Eventually, as an adult, a judge ordered her to stay there permanently. I never found out exactly what crime led to that final decision, but I can only imagine it must have been serious. She was, without a doubt, the most unsettling child I have ever encountered in my career. Story 5. I used to work as a paramedic, and one of the calls that has stayed with me forever was a house fire. When we arrived, the parents were outside, sobbing while holding a baby and their 7-year-old child. Nobody seemed physically hurt, but we began checking everyone anyway. Then our captain pointed us toward a police car where an 11-year-old girl was sitting. I won't go into graphic details, but she admitted that she had started the fire because she wanted to get rid of the baby. Shockingly, this wasn't the first time she had tried something like this. It was her third attempt, and she had already been placed in treatment facilities twice before. Years earlier, she had even gone after her older sibling, which led her living with her grandparents for a while. She was unlike any child I had ever seen. While her parents cried and her siblings were terrified, she giggled and seemed entertained by it all. But the moment she realized she was being sent back to a psychiatric ward, everything changed. It was like flipping a switch. Suddenly, she was begging her parents for help. Then she started making wild accusations, saying things that weren't true, even denying that they were her real parents or that she even lived there. Something had clearly happened in her life, but her story kept changing so often that it was impossible to know what was real. We stayed on that scene for more than 2 hours, which was much longer than most calls. Later, I learned from my cousin, who works at a state psychiatric hospital, that she was admitted several more times throughout the years. Eventually, when she became an adult, a judge ruled that she would live there permanently. I never found out exactly what led to that final decision, but it must have been very serious. She remains, to this day, the most unsettling child I have ever encountered in my career. Story 6. I'm not a psychiatrist, but when I was in my early 20s, I worked overnight shifts at a senior mental health facility, basically a unit for people 55 and older who needed medication adjustments or more specialized care. The place already felt eerie at night since all the lights were off except at the nurse's station. It was usually two RNs and me, a CNA, and I did 30-minute checks throughout the night. One time we admitted a woman in her 60s who had been brought in by her family. They didn't have much medical history for us to go on, so we had almost no background information. She came in with very severe bed sores from long-term neglect on her back, her legs, her heels, even her hips. Her behavior was heartbreaking and unsettling. She babbled like a baby, sometimes laughed loudly at random moments in the night, stared blankly into space, scratched at herself, and reached for things that weren't there. She didn't speak in a way we could understand, and it was impossible to really connect with her. Sometimes she would do things that were unhygienic or shocking, and it was very hard to watch. We ran a lot of tests, because without history or clear diagnosis, we had to figure out what was going on. After weeks of confusion, the doctors discovered the truth. This woman's condition was a result of an untreated infection that had been allowed to progress for years. By the time she was brought in, the damage to her brain was permanent. What made it so sad was the fact that this was preventable. If she had received proper care earlier, if her family had taken her to a doctor years before, she could have lived a normal life. Instead, her illness was left untreated.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
Until there was nothing anyone could do to bring her back. It wasn't so much scary, aside from her sudden outbursts or the eerie sound she made at night. It was mostly just heartbreaking to see someone suffer that much when a tragedy could have been avoided with basic care. Still sticks with me to this day. Neglect can be one of the cruelest things. Story 7. This isn't my story, but my mom's. She worked in an elementary school for a while, a school that had many children going through very difficult lives. She dealt with kids who were bullied, kids who came from abusive homes, and kids who carried a lot of pain. But there was one student who shook her more than any other. This little girl lived with her grandmother, since her parents were no longer around. She showed clear signs of serious mental illness, but her grandmother didn't fully understand or accept what was going on. My mom tried her best to help. She taught the girl ways to cope when she heard voices in her head, and even helped her through some very intense episodes. Then one day, the girl came into school and calmly told my mom something chilling. She said the voices had told her to harm the newborn puppies in their barn, and that she had done it. She even described how she had cleaned herself up afterward. At first, my mom couldn't believe it, but when she called a grandmother to check, the grandmother confirmed it without much reaction, saying, "Yes, she did." That moment stuck with my mom. Despite all her efforts, the girl never received real treatment for her mental illness, even though my mom pushed hard for it. Eventually, my mom left that job, and to this day, we have no idea what became of that child. It remains one of the most haunting memories from her career, not just because of what the girl had done, but because of how preventable it might have been if she had gotten the help she desperately needed. Story 8. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I've spent time as a patient in psych wards. Some of the people I met there are burned into my memory. One girl came in experiencing drug-induced psychosis. She had gone through a terrifying episode at home and ended up being admitted. Not long after, in the middle of the night, she ran into my room and just stood there, staring at me for a few minutes until staff came to take her back. She often tried to hide in my room because she was convinced people were out to harm her. She told us about something she called the redness, a man with glowing red pools instead of eyes who followed her. One night, I was woken up by the loudest scream I had ever heard. It sounded like pure terror. Later, she explained she had seen the redness outside her window. What made it heartbreaking was that outside of her episodes, she was such a kind girl. But in those moments, she lived in constant fear. Thankfully, she eventually made a full recovery. Today, she's living her life as a happy, confident person, proof that healing is possible. There was another girl I knew who was admitted to the psychiatric intensive care unit, the most serious section of the hospital. She had a very childlike personality and was completely obsessed with unicorns, but she carried deep scars, both physical and emotional. Sometimes, in the middle of a normal conversation, it was like a switch flipped. She would suddenly start banging her head against the wall with terrifying force, and afterwards she wouldn't even remember it happening. I never knew what caused so much pain in her life, but it was obvious she had suffered a lot. The hardest part being in those wards wasn't just the patients. It was knowing that sometimes the worst people there weren't the ones struggling with illness. There were predators who found ways to take advantage of vulnerable patients. I've unfortunately seen more of them than I wish I had. Story 9. I'm a psychiatrist, and over the years I've encountered a lot of patients, but the ones that stay with you are usually the most dangerous. The scariest are those who are severely psychotic, who have a history of attacking people without warning, and who have no awareness at all of their condition. One of the most memorable incidents happened with a very large patient of mine, well over 6 feet tall and about 300 pounds. He was furious at me for keeping him on the unit against his will. At one point, he threatened my life, locked eyes with me, and picked up a chair. He tried to smash through the glass of the nursing station. In the process, he seriously injured one security officer and knocked another unconscious. It eventually took more than 10 security officers to bring him down. And the entire time, he kept his eyes locked on me, screaming that he was going to kill me. That moment has never left me. I've had many intense situations in psychiatry, but that one was by far the most terrifying. Story 10. I work as a paralegal, and one of our clients once claimed that an accident had caused serious psychological symptoms. That's not unusual. People often report mental health struggles connected to accidents. As part of the process, he was referred to psychologists for evaluation. The report we got back, though, was unlike anything I'd ever seen. The psychologist wrote that she did not want him sent to her again. She said she felt deeply uncomfortable being in the same room with him. As it turned out, his history was disturbing. He had admitted to harming his dog because it damaged his furniture, and it also physically hurt his wife during an incident in a hotel. On top of that, he confessed that he would sometimes follow strangers home from supermarkets if he thought they had been rude to him. Most chilling of all, he said he had even considered harming a baby because the crying annoyed him. His explanation was that none of this was his real behavior, and that everything had changed since the accident. Personally, I didn't believe him for a second. It was one of the scariest clients we ever had, and we made sure he was never allowed to visit our offices again. Story 11. I'm a psychiatrist, and while I have had a few frightening moments, they're actually quite rare. The truth is, most of the situations where I felt uneasy were with patients who were very agitated and severely ill while on an inpatient unit. None of them ever intended to hurt me, and none of them actually did. In fact, the odds of a person with mental illness being harmed are far higher than the odds of someone with mental illness harming others. That's important to remember. When I do think back on the times I felt afraid, the fear never lasted long. It was always quickly replaced by sadness, because I can't imagine how terrifying it must feel to be trapped in your own mind, stuck in a locked unit, and battling that level of distress. There was one man in the clinic who tried to scare me, puffing out his chest, trying to act intimidating, but honestly, it was more show than anything else. I haven't worked much with people diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, but in the few cases I have, those situations have felt much more unsettling. Story 12. My dad used to work as a cleaner at ST, Andrews Hospital. He once told me he went into the teenage brain injury ward, but only once. Whatever he saw there shook him so much that he refused to ever go back in, and to this day, he won't talk about what he witnessed. But some of the other patients he's mentioned over the years were really unforgettable. There was a minor royal who had been locked away decades ago simply because she was in a same-gender relationship. There was also a surgeon who suddenly developed kleptomania and had to have exactly 42 of everything. Then there was a man who believed he was still living on his sheep farm. He mistook an elderly patient for a runaway sheep and tragically hurt her when he tackled her to the ground. The stories my dad told me from that hospital are haunting, sad, and strange all at once. Some of them sound almost unbelievable, but they remind you how fragile the human mind really is. Story 13. I once had a patient who was a former military member and, at the time, was working as a hired gun. He often tried to talk about his jobs, but I would always cut him off and insist I didn't want to hear the details. He would call me constantly between our sessions, and I always had to keep boundaries firm. During our last session together, I gave him a piece of advice. I suggested he go to his upcoming 10-year high school reunion, maybe reconnect with old friends, maybe even see a long-lost love. He seemed to take the suggestion seriously. Not long after that, I saw the news. There had been a massive shootout at a large house in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, right near where his reunion was supposed to be. To this day, I don't know if he was involved, but the timing and everything I knew about him still leaves me chill when I think about it. Story 14. Not a psychiatrist, but I once had a therapist who completely overreacted to something I said. At one point, I made a dumb joke about those expanding plastic ball toys. I said you could fit a baby inside one. It was just a terrible offhand joke, nothing more. But my therapist took it way too seriously. She actually compared me to Charles Manson and even messed with my medication in a way that wasn't right. For the record, I haven't harmed anyone. I'm definitely not hot, and I'm most certainly not Charles Manson. It was one bad joke, and she treated me like a monster. Story 15. I used to work as a psych tech in an inpatient psychiatric hospital. At the time, I was 24. During the day, I worked as a case manager, helping adults with severe mental illness who could still live fairly independently with some support. At night, I worked 4 p.m. to 12 a.m. in the hospital, mostly in the locked unit called Center Hall, where the most psychotic and aggressive patient stayed, the man with demons in the road. As a case manager, one of my patients had schizophrenia. With medication, he could usually recognize that his visions and voices weren't real, but they still terrified him. He worked a basic job, lived in his own apartment, and on the outside looked like he was holding things together. But every time I visited, he would quietly tell me how the voices urged him to lay down in the middle of the street. He didn't want to, because he believed demons were rising up through the asphalt. He knew it wasn't real, but it felt real to him, and he lived in constant fear of it. It was heartbreaking to see. Aiden, the most frightening moment. Another client of mine, let's call him Aiden, had both antisocial personality disorder and schizophrenia. On medication, he lived with his mom and worked part-time at a grocery store, though the meds left him very flat and zombie-like. One time, he stopped taking them and ended up admitted to the hospital where I worked nights. I was the one admitting him, and we were short-staffed, so it was just me in the admitting room. He was talking nonstop, saying things like how tinfoil earplugs could block the government from reading his thoughts and how he needed a pregnancy test because he thought he was expecting. I just nodded along while checking his vitals. Out of nowhere, he jumped up, pinned me against the wall by the throat, and in a chilling voice told me he knew where I lived and that one night he'd come find me. Then just as suddenly, another tech walked in and Aiden let go. He sat down like nothing had happened and calmly asked again for a pregnancy test. I wasn't physically hurt, but I was shaken to the core. Later, when his symptoms were under control again, he apologized and said it was the demon inside him speaking, not him. Ashley and the message from my brother. Then there was Ashley, a young woman brought in by police. She'd been arrested and during the process became extremely agitated, telling them she wanted to end her life. That was enough for them to bring her to us. She was loud, aggressive, and completely caught up in her delusions. She screamed that Biggie and Tupac were still alive and that they were outside in the trees with sniper rifles waiting to take out staff as they left. But then she turned to me. She locked eyes with me and said, "By the way, your brother Ryan says he's fine and not to worry about him." The world froze in that moment. I had never seen this girl before in my life, and my brother Ryan had died from a drug overdose 2 years earlier. No one at that hospital knew about him, and I lived hours away from where my family was. To this day, I don't know how to explain it. Story 16. I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner, so here's another, not a psychiatrist, but I've had two moments in my career that genuinely scared me. The first patient. The first was partly on me. I didn't realize until it was too late that I was the only person in my hallway who never took a lunch break. One day, I had a patient scheduled at noon, just him and me, alone in that quiet hallway. He's a level 3 offender and can be highly inappropriate at times, but on this particular day, he was also clearly psychotic. He didn't threaten me directly, but the way he looked at me, the way he responded to my questions, and the inappropriate things he said were enough to make me fear something could happen. That half-hour session felt like forever. After that, for a while, I always had his case manager sitting on our visit. Thankfully, he's been a bit more stable recently, though when he uses meth, it's a long process to get him back on track. The second patient. The second situation was also tied to meth use. A patient called me one day, very upset, insisting he needed to see me urgently to talk about something personal. I expected him to bring up medication side effects. Instead, he admitted he'd been buying ADHD medication illegally and wanted me to prescribe it to him. I refused, of course, and he stormed out, angry, yelling, and making threatening remarks. A week or two later, one of my co-workers, his therapist, told me something chilling. The patient had said he wanted to slash my tires, that he carried a knife, and that he wanted to kill me. I don't work in a big hospital, just a small rural clinic, one day a week, which means it wouldn't take much effort for someone to figure out which car was mine in the parking lot. For a while after hearing that, I was extremely paranoid, mentally running through scenarios of how I would defend myself if he showed up. Story 17. Late to the party. But I thought this was worth sharing. Obligatory, not a psychiatrist, but I'm an adult social worker. Most of the people I work with struggle with substance use, mental health problems, or both. I was assigned a new case, a man in his early 50s living in a hostel. The first time I met him, I could tell right away that he was very unwell. I spoke with the staff there, and we all agreed he needed to be assessed by a psychiatrist as soon as possible. He had been diagnosed with schizophrenia and was also using heroin and crack. In the UK, sadly, when someone has both serious mental illness and is actively using drugs, they're often turned away in a crisis because professionals can't easily tell what's real and what's caused by the substances. That meant it was on me to get him to help. Calling an ambulance wasn't an option because that automatically brings the police too, and he had a deep fear of emergency services. So we decided I would escort him myself in a taxi. According to our policy, I had to sit in the back seat with him. About halfway through the ride, everything changed. He suddenly grew very agitated and began shouting that he now knew who I really was. In his mind, I was Florence Nightingale, and he believed that I had harmed him in childhood. He said I needed to be punished and talked about stabbing Florence to drive the evil out. He was a small man, very thin and fragile, maybe 5'2", but I was absolutely terrified. It wasn't his size that scared me. It was the look in his eyes. He was deeply frightened himself, and he truly believed every word he was saying. In that moment, I was afraid for my own safety, but also devastated to see just how far from reality the human mind can drift when illness takes hold. Despite everything, he really was a kind man underneath it all. That's what made it so heartbreaking. Story 18. Not a psychiatrist, but my therapist once seemed a little unsettled by some dreams I told him about. They were dreams where I harmed people, not something I would ever consider in real life. I've never wanted to hurt anyone. It was just my brain's way of venting anger at people who frustrate me. The dreams themselves could get pretty graphic, which is probably why my therapist reacted the way they did. But for me, they've always just been dreams, nothing more. Story 19. I met him 15 years ago. They told me there was nothing there, no empathy, no conscience, no understanding of right or wrong. When I looked at him, I saw a 6-year-old child with a face like a blank mask, eyes so dark and empty, they didn't seem human at all. For 8 years, I tried to reach him, to help him. And for 7 more, I fought to make sure he stayed locked away. Because what I realized was that behind those eyes wasn't a person I could reach. What I saw was something cold, empty, something that felt like pure evil. Story 20. Not a psychiatrist, but I've been in a psychiatric hospital several times. Sadly, my experience wasn't great. It often felt like they just gave us medication, billed the insurance, and then sent us back out without real help. On my last day, I had a roommate who had been admitted 23 times before. One day we were in our room together when she suddenly shut the door and started pacing back and forth. Then, without warning, she picked up a chair and threw it at the door and the window. She was much bigger than me, and in that moment, I was terrified. I really thought she might hurt me. Story 21. I was on the other side once, not as a doctor or nurse, but as a patient who scared the professional I went to see. At the time, I felt like I was losing control of myself. I was filled with so much anger and dark thoughts toward one person that I couldn't shake it. Every day, I would play it out of my head, thinking about what I wanted to do. Sometimes I'd even feel a sudden urge if I saw an opportunity. It scared me how strong those feelings were. Deep down, I knew it wasn't right. I knew it could ruin my life and someone else's, but the thought of relief kept me trapped. I recognized how dangerous those thoughts were, so I pushed myself to get therapy as soon as possible. It took a few tries, but eventually I gathered the courage to tell my therapist everything I was thinking. When I finally admitted it, I could see the fear in his face. That reaction made me stop going to him altogether. Looking back, though, I realized the important part wasn't his reaction. It was that I asked for help. Speaking the words out loud was the hardest part, but it was also the first step toward pulling myself away from that place. Story 22. I'm a psychiatrist, and honestly, I've always felt safest working inpatient. Even though many of the patients there may be experiencing psychosis, the staff and the environment are much better set up to handle those situations. In the last few years, the only time I really felt unnerved was in my outpatient clinic. A man came in demanding an extremely high dose of Adderall and flat out refused to consider any other options. He just sat there, angry, and wouldn't leave my office. Eventually, I had to get up, open the door, and basically guide him out. What worried me most was that he was impulsive, very angry, and I knew he had access to firearms. That thought sat in the back of my mind for a while. It's been over a year now, and nothing ever came of it. But in that moment, yeah, it definitely rattled me. Story 23. I'm a therapist, and this story actually happened to one of my mentors. He was working at a community clinic in another city. It was the end of the day, and he was about to leave when the secretary asked if he could do an emergency intake for someone who had just walked in claiming to be in crisis. My mentor agreed and went to the waiting room to bring the man back. He said that the moment he opened the door, he had a strange feeling. Usually, he never sat behind his desk when meeting clients, but this time, something told him to sit there. When he asked what brought the man in, the client suddenly shouted, "I am St. Francis of Assisi, and I am destined to die." He ripped open his shirt, showing fresh cuts on his chest, and then pulled out a knife, yelling, "And you are destined to die too." Now, most people would have panicked, but somehow my mentor stayed calm. He slammed his hands on the desk and shouted back, "St. Francis of Assisi." Holy cow, what an honor. That reaction startled the man. It also caught the attention of the secretary, who cracked open the door, saw the knife, and immediately called the police. The man bolted out of the office, ran down the hall, and escaped out a back door. There was a manhunt for several hours before the police finally found him. They never recovered the knife. The lesson my mentor told me afterward has stuck with me ever since. Never be afraid to be crazier than your clients. Story 24. I used to do in-home family therapy. One of my clients lived in a very remote area, and our sessions often ended in the early evening. This parent had serious mental health struggles, and because I was the one who often communicated with child welfare and crisis services when there was risk, they began to see me as the cause of many of their problems. One evening, things escalated. The parent grew agitated, started yelling about how much they hated me, and then described a dream they'd had the night before in graphic detail. In the dream, they had cut off my head and thrown my body parts into the local river. I didn't wait around. I immediately left, even though it was winter, icy, pitch dark roads. As I pulled away, they stood on the porch screaming after me that I couldn't abandon them. That night stayed with me. I really do believe in the home and community therapy model. You get a lot done sitting at someone's kitchen table. It feels real and people open up, but the trade-off is safety. I work with women whose abusive husbands knew I was helping them plan to leave. I worked with parents who knew they were on the verge of losing their kids because of what I had to report. As valuable as that work was, one of the biggest reasons I left is that, in the end, it just didn't feel safe. Story 25. I used to work in community-based psych rehab, and I had a couple of clients who really scared me. The first was extremely ill. He was about twice my weight and over a foot taller than me. I'm only 5 feet 2 inches and 115 pounds. One day, he sat next to me and started trying to brush bugs off my upper leg. Then he suddenly told me he wanted to hurt me in gruesome ways. I immediately called 911, and he was taken to the hospital. But to my shock, they released him the very same night. I called a provider and reported that he clearly needed more care, but the hospital refused to adjust his medications. It left me feeling completely unprotected. Another client absolutely hated me. He was on house arrest for attempted murder, and every time I had to see him, I dreaded it. He would explode over the smallest things, like if I wouldn't let him use my cell phone or refuse to drive him somewhere. Sitting across from him, never knowing when he'd lose his temper, was exhausting and terrifying. Story 26. My mother-in-law used to be a family doctor. One night, I went to her practice to drive her home, and I was waiting alone in the lobby. The place was emptying out, and by the time the last patient was in with her, I was the only one left. The receptionist went downstairs to grab a coffee, so I was sitting there by myself. That's when this haggard-looking man rolled in, sitting in a wheelchair. He wheeled over right next to me, coughing and looking like he was in really bad shape. The last patient left, and a few minutes later, my mother-in-law came out. The moment she saw him, she said firmly, "Mr. underscore, 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 please leave." He started rambling, saying things like how he was in so much pain and couldn't walk anymore. He kept repeating that line. "I cannot walk anymore," she warned him. "If you don't leave, I'll have to call the police." And suddenly, the man jumped out of the wheelchair and ran straight at her. My brain could hardly process it. One second, he couldn't walk, and the next, he was charging forward. Thankfully, I was young and in decent shape back then. I jumped up and managed to push him against the wall before he could reach her. He was way stronger than I expected, and in the back of my mind, I realized how bad this could have gone. My mother-in-law quickly locked herself in the Glaston reception office, something she had clearly done before. Meanwhile, I let the guy go, maybe not the smartest choice in case he had a weapon, but at the time I thought I was invincible. Surprisingly, he ignored me completely and just started pounding on the glass, swearing at her while she stayed safe inside. Then came the one almost funny moment in all of this. The secretary came back up with her coffee, saw what was happening, froze for a second, then bolted the other way so fast she spilled the coffee everywhere. The look on her face was priceless, though the man didn't even notice. After about 5 minutes, the police arrived. Strangely enough, he calmed down right away when they showed up. They cuffed him, took him out, and we spent the next hour giving statements. Eventually, I was able to drive her home. She explained afterward that he was just there trying to get drugs, something she'd dealt with more times than she could count. But what stuck with me was watching a man who insisted he couldn't walk jump up and run across the room like that. I'll never forget it. Story 27. When I was working as a nurse aide in a care facility, we had a very difficult case come in. A large man in his late 50s was admitted with alcohol-related dementia. These kind of patients are often high risk for aggression, and from the very first day, he caused a lot of problems. He tried to run away, harassed female residents, and picked fights with male residents. The average age of our residents was mid-70s, but this man was much younger and physically stronger, so we had to watch him closely. Because I was considered the strong one on the team, I was always called when he needed to be managed. After about a week, he seemed to decide he'd had enough of me getting in his way. One day, he suddenly went for me. There I was, 23 years old, 5 feet 10 inches, and about 145 pounds, trying to hold off a 6 feet 5 inches, 250-pound muscular man. He grabbed a belt and tried to wrap it around my neck. The only backup I had in that moment was a 5-foot-tall co-worker who was terrified but still tugged at his shirt with all her strength, trying to pull him off me. Meanwhile, several elderly residents stood around us screaming. It must have been a wild scene to witness. Thankfully, I managed to break free from his grip. A couple of male staff members ran over and were able to restrain him long enough for him to calm down. The very next day, he was transferred to a facility better equipped to handle patients like him. That whole week was exhausting and frightening, and that incident was one I'll never forget. Story 28. I've worked in both male and female prisons, and so many stories come to mind. One that really stuck with me happened when I was 24, meeting with a male inmate in his 40s. He was easily double my size. For reference, he looked about the size of Michael Clark Duncan. He had severe anger issues, and I was meeting with him to provide psychological testing. He was developmentally delayed, but because of his size, when he got angry, he could do some real damage. He once picked up a heavy metal trash bin and threw it across the room. He admitted to me that he sometimes had rage blackouts and worried he might hurt me if he ever lost control during our sessions. One thing he told me was that he liked roses, even fake ones. So I went to a store and bought a set of artificial flowers and kept them with me just in case. Sure enough, one day during a session, another staff member kept interrupting us, coming into the office repeatedly. Finally, they told me to cut the session short. I could see it happening, his body stiffening, fists clenching, face tightening. He was about to lose it. I didn't hesitate. I pulled out the flowers and handed them to him. He sat back down, holding them, gently petting the petals. Little by little, he calmed down. In my years working with inmates, I've seen a lot. Breaking up fights, being around pepper spray, witnessing severe self-harm, dealing with threats, and sitting across from people who truly wanted to hurt me. But I can honestly say that was the one moment where I felt like something very bad was about to happen, and the only thing that stopped it were those flowers. Story 29. Not me, but an obligatory not me story about my dad. Back in the 70s, my dad was a social worker in San Francisco. One night, he got a call about one of his clients who was having a severe mental health crisis and had locked herself in a hotel room. He went to the hotel and tried to get into her room, but couldn't. Instead, he went to a room directly above hers, climbed out onto their balcony, and lowered himself down to hers, 9 stories up. When he got inside, the situation had already gotten dangerous. She had injured herself and was coming at him with a knife. My dad managed to disarm her, then wrapped his arms around her in a bear hug to keep her safe. He carried her out of the room, into the elevator, and all the way down to the street where an ambulance was waiting. The police only showed up about 5 minutes later. By then, my dad had already handled it. When he finally came home that night, he was completely covered in blood. Story 30. Oh, boy. I have so many stories from my time in training, but this one really sticks out. I was a brand new therapist, still in graduate school, working overnights at an inpatient facility. My job was to interview new patients when they first arrived. Keep in mind, most of these people did not want to be there and were admitted against their will, and I was the first face they saw. At night, I was the only staff member in that entire wing until the patients were moved to the unit. One night, I had a list of new admissions. I met with one patient, and honestly, I don't remember much about them specifically. What I do remember is this. Every single door behind you locks with a code. I walked in, sat with a patient, and when it was time to leave, my mind went completely blank. I could not, for the life of me, remember the code to get out. Try and keep my cool, I sat back down and told them something like, "I'll just stay with you a little longer," pretending it was part of the process. But inside, I was panicking. The more anxious I got, the less I could think clearly. I tried several codes. None of them worked. The patient knew exactly what was happening, but thankfully, they were calm about it, and eventually I figured it out and got out of the room. Then I looked down at the next name on my intake list. It was someone with a history of repeated sexual offenses, diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. This person was known to be aggressive and antagonistic, and all I could think was, if I had forgotten that code while locked in the room with that patient instead, things could have gone very, very badly. Not long after that, I switched to day shifts. During the day, there were always at least 2 of us doing interviews and plenty of staff nearby, a much safer setup. Story 31. I've been the subject of erotomania in a patient with psychosis. For context, erotomania is a rare delusional disorder where someone believes another person is secretly in love with them. The person they fixate on is usually unattainable, someone married, of higher status, uninterested, or even someone they've never actually met. People with erotomania often think they're receiving secret messages from the person, like through license plates, TV shows, or random events. In my case, the patient thought I looked like his ex-wife, a woman he had a violent history with. During the admission interview, he stared at me the entire time, completely fixated. That isn't unusual in itself. But soon I became the only staff member who could convince him to take his medication or calm down during aggressive episodes. Then the love letters started. He would slip them under the nurse's station door. Eventually, he was moved to another ward. Not long after, he became so determined to get back to mine that he physically attacked a nurse trying to take his keys. He ended up in restraint and seclusion. The last I heard, he was offering money to other patients who were about to be discharged, asking them to hang around the parking lot in the evening to figure out which car I drove. It was one of the most unsettling experiences of my career, a mix of fear, vulnerability, and a realization of how powerful delusions can be. Story 32. There was one man I'll never forget. He was huge, over 2 meters tall and more than 200 kilos, but with the emotional regulation of a child. He had disabilities, and one day he was told there were no scheduled activities. He just couldn't cope with that and started smashing up the place. The police were called, and thankfully, he never went after any staff or residents. But standing there, watching him tear things apart, I remember thinking he looked like he could crush me with one hand if he wanted to. It was terrifying. Another time, a co-worker had a resident confront him with a knife. The man said the voices in his head were telling him to hurt him. My coworker calmly told him, "That's not true. Put the knife down." And incredibly, he did. It's important to note, people with schizophrenia are far more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators. In both these cases, despite the fear and intensity, no one was actually harmed. Story 33. I used to work as a medical assistant in a community health clinic in a major West Coast city. My job was to room patients, take vitals, confirm medications, and draw blood if needed. One day, a new patient came in for a wellness visit. He mentioned he had just gotten out of a large prison in the area. That didn't surprise me much. We saw a lot of patients who had done time, so I just continued with the intake. When we got a medication section, he told me he was on testosterone, a very high dose, much higher than what we typically give to our trans patients. I double-checked to make sure I heard correctly, and he explained it was because of his Klinefelter syndrome. Then he started describing his symptoms in extreme detail. Honestly, more detail than I ever needed to know about his body, but at least he was open. Many patients aren't, so I just went along with it. Then, out of nowhere, he leaned in and said he had a secret. He wanted me to come closer to hear it. I stayed back and told him I could hear fine from where I was. That's when he told me he had twisted desires. He said he wanted to humiliate women he saw on the streets until they were terrified. He said he wanted to hurt them just because they were women. I kept calm and gave him my standard response. Thank you for trusting me with your thoughts. I know that can be difficult. Then I wrapped up the intake and told him the nurse practitioner would be in soon. As I opened the door, he looked at me and said, "You look just like the women I think about." I got chills. I immediately reported everything to the head physician and clinic manager. The issue was he needed urgent blood work to make sure he wasn't harming himself with that level of testosterone, and I was the only one trained to draw blood that day. I said I'd do it, but only if someone came with me. They sent a 5'2" intern who was clearly terrified, and honestly, so was I. During the draw, things were tense but calm. He actually had great veins, and I finished quickly. As I was labeling the tubes, he stood up, gave me this chilling smile, and said, "Do you want to know why I was in prison? I assaulted 3 women. That's why. Have a great day, sweetheart." Then he sat back down like nothing had happened. I don't think I've ever left a patient room faster in my life. The intern looked shaken and didn't know what to do. I honestly believe if that intern hadn't been there, things might have gone very differently. The look in that man's eyes, I'll never forget it. Story 34. I, 22F, was doing an internship in internal medicine. One day I walked into a triple room, 3 patients sharing the same space. I greeted the first patient, a 55-year-old man who had just come up from ER after a heart attack. Without warning, he jumped up and started attacking me. In the process, he ripped out his 4 lines and the heart monitor. I tried to protect myself and also shield the family members from the other beds. Nurses came running, and together we managed to restrain him with the help of emergency medication to calm him down. Later, I found out the truth. A year earlier, he had suffered a massive stroke that damaged his frontal lobe and cortex, leaving him with extreme aggression. That's also why he didn't have any family members with him. They couldn't safely care for him anymore. Another time, still as an intern. This was in a public hospital in one of the most dangerous cities in Mexico during 2012, right at the height of the drug war. A senior woman came in with a large breast tumor. After examining her, we realized it was too advanced for surgery or treatment, and the only option left was palliative care. When her son heard this, he became furious. He pulled out a gun, illegal in Mexico, but common among cartel members, and threatened both the oncologist and me, saying that if anything happened to his mother, he would come after us. I finished my term at that hospital a few weeks later. After those experiences and others like them, I promised myself I would never go back. Story 35. I'm a social worker, and at one point I worked as a clinical case manager on an adolescent residential unit at a psychiatric hospital. One of my clients was scheduled for a visit with his mom. It was the first time in about 6 years he'd been allowed to see her, so it was a really big deal. Per the plan, I drove him to her house, the same one he grew up in. But when we got there, she wasn't home. We found out she was at the methadone clinic. This was before smartphones, so getting there wasn't easy. We got lost driving through a pretty rough neighborhood. But eventually we found her waiting outside. We picked her up and went back to the house. We were sitting in the front room together. My client started pacing around, just looking at things. Out of nowhere, he went over to the sofa, reached behind it, and pulled out a rifle. His whole face lit up and he said, "It's still here." Then he looked at me and added, "It's not loaded." He turned to his mom and asked, "Is it?" She barely reacted. She just sighed, said something like, "Oh, for crying out loud, give me that," and took it from him like it was nothing more than a remote control. She casually put it back behind the sofa. Meanwhile, he was smiling and mumbling to himself. She looked completely checked out, and I was sitting there trying not to jump out of my skin. Trying to keep things safe, I suggested we continue the visit at the local McDonald's, my treat. And that's exactly what we did. Afterward, we dropped her back off and returned to the hospital. Eventually, my client was discharged into a transitional living program for young adults. I never forgot him or that visit. Story 36. I'm a retired NYC paramedic, and one of the calls I'll never forget was back in the 1980s. We were assigned to transport a psychiatric patient from a small ER that didn't have a behavioral unit to another hospital with proper psychiatric facilities. When we arrived, the woman was calm. She'd already been medicated and seemed cooperative. I explained to her that during the transport, she'd only need to deal with me and that I'd treat her with respect as long as she did the same. We searched her, cleared her, and then had to wait for paperwork. A nurse made an error on the forms, so we ended up sitting there longer than usual before we were finally clear to go. We got her loaded into the ambulance, turned on the AC, and I started talking to her about needing to take her vitals. That's when everything changed. Out of nowhere, she pulled a broken pair of scissors from her clothes and lunged at me. She aimed for my chest, but I was wearing a Kevlar vest that stopped the worst of it. Still, the blade slipped through enough to cut into me. I remember the shock, the smell of my own body, seeing blood spread across my white shirt. Adrenaline took over. I fought her off and managed to knock her unconscious while trying to keep myself from collapsing. My partner spun the rig around and headed straight back to the hospital. I dropped to the floor and grabbed supplies from our trauma bag, pressing dressings against my wound to slow the bleeding. I even gave myself an injection for the pain because I knew if I passed out, I might not wake up. The rest is a blur. They told me, later I was trying to warn the others about the weapon, but the words weren't coming out. The next thing I knew, I was being rushed straight into the trauma bay. I woke up a few days later. As for her, she had been through horrific things long before I met her. Her mental illness was just another layer of suffering on top of that. I didn't want to hurt her, and I don't carry anger toward her even now. She was sick, she was broken, and I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. That call nearly killed me. But also reminded me that behind every outburst, every crisis, there's usually a lifetime of pain. Story 37. I work in addiction medicine. One of my patients had schizoaffective disorder. Every so often, he would stop taking his meds and go on a binge with drugs. Each time, he'd eventually come back to us for help. The last time I saw him, he was completely off his medication, high, and actively hallucinating. He told me straight up that he was seeing monsters in the room, and he kept glancing around while talking to me. At first, things seemed calm enough, but the second I put my stethoscope on his chest, something changed. His whole body tensed up, he stopped answering my questions, and he got this cold, distant stare. Right then, I had this crystal clear thought. He's going to strangle me with my stethoscope. I immediately stepped back and said, "Okay, we're done here." He stood up, walked out into the hall, and thankfully the staff was able to give him emergency medication to calm him down. It ended safely, but in that moment, I was genuinely terrified. Story 38. I used to work in an emergency department, and one of the worst days of my career started like any other. A psychiatrist was meeting with a patient in her office when suddenly, the patient snapped and attacked her with a knife. She started screaming for help, and an off-duty police officer who happened to be in the waiting room heard her. He rushed into the office, pulled his weapon, and shot the patient to stop the attack. They were both rushed to our ED at the same time. The psychiatrist survived, but just barely. The patient died from the gunshot wound to his head. It was one of the darkest days I've ever experienced in medicine. Story 39. I'm a nurse, and at the time I worked on a critical care step-down floor, basically for patients who were very sick, but not quite ICU-level sick, or people coming down from the ICU once they were a little more stable. We were kind of the catch-all floor for tough cases. One day, we had a man brought in who was under arrest for taking his girlfriend's life. Whenever someone is in custody in a hospital, they always have an officer posted with them. He had been using bath salts and was completely out of his mind for about 3 days straight. At first, we tried the normal protocol, shackles, but it became clear really fast after several attempts to lunge at staff that this wasn't going to work. Within hours, he was placed in four-point locked restraints. These are heavy leather restraints with locks, meant for extreme situations. By the second day, things escalated again. Anytime we got close enough to provide care, he would spit at us or try to bite, so we had to use a spit hood just to protect staff. Even then, he would still snap toward us whenever we provided treatment. By the third day, he finally started to come back to reality a little. We were able to take the spit hood off, but he stayed in full restraints for the rest of his stay. It was one of the most chaotic and nerve-wracking cases I ever had to deal with in nursing. Story 40. I worked in an ER that had a secure mental health unit attached. Sounds good, right? The problem was someone had overlooked a pretty big design flaw. There was an access hatch in the bathroom ceiling. One day, a patient figured it out. He climbed up into the ceiling, trying to make an escape. For a second, it seemed like he might actually pull it off, but then he made it only a few feet before crashing straight to the ceiling tiles and landed right in the middle of the clinician's write-up room. To say we were startled would be the understatement of the year. Papers flew, people screamed, and suddenly there was just a guy lying on the floor in front of us. Thankfully, security happened to be in the room at that moment. They jumped in immediately and got him under control before he could get up and run again. It was one of those moments where you just look around at each other and think, did that really just happen? Story 41. I'm a therapist, and one of the scariest moments of my career involved a client who had stopped taking his medication. Normally, he wasn't a violent person, but he had a traumatic brain injury that made him impulsive and paranoid. On this particular day, he told me he had a very specific plan to kill his roommate because he believed his roommate was plotting to hurt him. Per protocol, I had to let him know I would need to call 911. That's when things got really tense. He looked me dead in the eye and said that if I called the police, he would do everything he could to commit suicide by cop. My stomach dropped. In that moment, I knew that one wrong word from me could escalate the situation into tragedy. So instead of reacting quickly, I slowed down. I talked with him, carefully, step by step, exploring his options, validating how scared and overwhelmed he felt, but also reminding him that there were safer choices. We sat there for hours. Finally, he agreed to go to the hospital, but only if I went with him. So I did. The exchange with police when he was getting into the ambulance was incredibly tense, but he stayed calm, and they managed to get him to the ER. Within hours of getting his medication back into his system, he was stable again and back to himself. I've had other frightening moments in my work, like one patient who tried to harm herself with her own fingernails right in the middle of session when I was still an intern. But that day, with the threat of suicide by cop hanging in the air, was hands down the scariest of my career. Story 42. My father served as a trauma surgeon in the Iranian military during the Iran-Iraq conflict. In the mid-80s, he was deployed to Iraq, working in a rough battlefield hospital with very limited resources. One day, while he was in the operating room removing metal fragments from a wounded soldier's stomach, the unimaginable happened. A huge explosive round tore through the wall of the operating room, passing just 2 or 3 feet from him and the patient. He froze for a moment, realizing how close both of them had just come to losing their lives. But then he took a deep breath, reassessed the situation, and went right back to work. In the end, the soldier survived, and my father walked away deeply shaken, but proud that he hadn't given up in that moment of chaos. Story 43. Back in college, my clinical psychology professor told us a story that honestly gave me chills. She said that years ago, when she worked at a psychiatric facility, she used to wear her hair very long, all the way down to her waist. One day, she was interacting with a patient who suddenly began having vivid hallucinations. In his mind, her long hair wasn't hair at all. He thought it was a mass of vicious snakes. In a panic, he grabbed her hair and started yanking on it with all his strength. She said the force was so strong that he ended up pulling out actual chunks of her hair, scalp included. It was a traumatic moment, one she never forgot. From that day forward, she kept her hair cut short in a pixie style. She joked about it years later in class, but you could tell it was one of those experiences that left a permanent mark. Story 44. I used to work with people who had schizophrenia, and one of my patients disappeared for about 24 hours. That meant he missed 2 rounds of his medication. When he finally came back, I could tell immediately he was on something super high, restless, and escalating fast. I only knew for sure because I knew my patients so well. I called the police for transport, but they didn't believe me at first. While I was waiting, things got dangerous. He cornered me, which never happened, because I always kept an exit nearby. But he moved so quickly that I backed into the wall. He got right up close to me, his eyes wide, and said in this low voice that he could hurt me before anyone even realized I was in trouble. My heart was pounding, but I stayed calm, and then, just like that, he snapped out of it and backed away. When the police finally showed up, I had to practically flirt with one of the officers just to get him to take me seriously. In the end, I didn't hold it against my patient. It was the drugs and missing his meds. But as soon as it was all over, I had this huge adrenaline crash. That moment honestly proved to me that I'm really good at handling a crisis. It was terrifying, but it also showed me how strong and steady I can be under pressure.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.